1231. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're talking about the 14th Amendment and your rights today. My guests are Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Michael Gerhardt, University of North Carolina constitutional law professor. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let me go back to the phone lines. Deborah, calling from Maryland. Deborah, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Deborah, are you there? Whoops. There we go. Deborah.
For me, my daughter, and my son.
Deborah, let's back up because I didn't catch the beginning of that.
I have taken real estate session classes through Montgomery County government and have been on about 32-year different waiting lists at a time. They keep telling me to go to HOC, and HOC is closed. They tell me to go to the...
Okay, Deborah, I'm not sure what you're referring to. You may be talking about an issue that we are not discussing tonight. But if you do want to talk about the 14th Amendment, please, I welcome your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before the break, I was reaching out to Professor Gerhardt about the specifics of the 1989 decision regarding flag burning. Let us just say, for argument's sake, that this issue continues to come up. Is there a way to change that law, or is this said law of the land?
Well, I think there are two obvious ways to try and change it. The first one would be to have the Supreme Court change its mind, to sort of overrule itself. They'll keep in mind there are two decisions together that say this, so one or both would have to be overruled. Given not just how old they are, but also given the fact that they've not really been contested since they were decided, and also given the fact that a majority of the Supreme Court currently seems to be quite in favor of robust political expression, it would seem the chances for having the court overrule itself are not great, but they're possible. The other is to have a formal constitutional amendment, which would be even more difficult. You'd have to get not just it coming out of Congress or the states, but you'd have to get a supermajority of states to be able to approve it. That might happen, but that process is never easy and almost always fails.
I was about to ask, I mean, how often does something like that really happen? Professor.
It does. I mean, we've had a handful of Supreme Court decisions over in American history that have been overruled through constitutional amendment, but there have been a lot more decisions that have been threatened through possible amendments. So it's hard. And keep in mind that among the amendments that did overrule Supreme Court decisions, some of them involved the horrific Dred Scott decision from the 1850s, and that required a civil war to kind of set the stage for those amendments. So overruling Supreme Court decisions is not easy.
Elizabeth, when 150 years ago, when you talk about, you know, some of the tenets of the 14th Amendment, marriage equality, gender equality, those are modern terms. Were those considerations back then, and how do they really apply today?
So I think, you know, when we talk about issues like that, the place to start is looking at the words of the 14th Amendment. And that's why when we were talking about it to begin with, I think it's so important that the framers of the 14th Amendment chose to say that no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. And they thought about this very carefully. They certainly, given that we just went through this terrible civil war, that we were repudiating the evils of slavery, they did consider writing something that was directly focused on racial discrimination. But they decided that they would write something that included a prohibition on discrimination on the basis of race, but also make it broader. And that was explicitly debated, this broadening, using the term any person. So while, yes, they did not talk about in the debates whether or not gay and lesbians could marry the person of their choosing, they did talk about wanting to make sure that this was a sweeping declaration of equality. They specifically talked about, for example, the fact that that would cover the immigrant as well as the citizen. They used the words citizen or stranger would get the equal protection of the laws. They intentionally and wanted it to cover people who expressed an unpopular opinion. So there was a problem with white abolitionists in the South being targeted by Southern state governments for advocating for the end of slavery and for equality for all people. So they did want to have a sweeping protection for equality. So we begin with the words, and obviously any person includes men and women.
But do they mean women? I mean, we're talking, you know, 150 years ago, persons, let's be honest, they were talking about men. And one could argue that even today, that one of the biggest debates when it comes to women and equality is equal pay.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here we are in the 21st century. Does that argument, that discussion about equal pay for men and women belong in this same discussion about the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, and I think for two reasons. One, the equal treatment that's promised to us in the 14th Amendment, and also the idea of equal citizenship that is less directly expressed, but I think is contained in the idea that all who are born here are born citizens at birth and are entitled to the equal protection of the laws. And, you know, specifically with respect to women, I think that's even strengthened when you look at the 19th Amendment, which ensures that women have the right to vote, which some see as the cornerstone of citizenship. So when you put all of those together, I think it's a resounding affirmation of the equal citizenship of women as well as men. And, you know, the idea of being able to be a true equal citizen encompasses much more than just being able to, you know, have that denotation on your passport. It is something more than just being named a citizen. It's about really exercising that. And we've seen that actually Justice Ginsburg has couched her abortion and reproductive freedom decisions in part in the language of equal citizenship, saying how can women be equal citizens as men if they can't decide for themselves whether or not to have a child? And I think the economic aspects of equal citizenship, if we go back to the time of the passage of the 14th Amendment, you look at what the Congress that drafted and passed the 14th Amendment was doing with respect to trying to ameliorate the deep and cruel inequality of the slave power in the United States. They sought to create the Freedmen's Bank to ensure that African Americans were given equal economic opportunity in terms of banking and trying to accumulate wealth that had been denied to them as their labor was stolen by slavery. You also look at education, the opportunity to advance oneself educationally and thus economically. The idea of being able to be an equal citizen on all footing clearly included to those who drafted the 14th Amendment the ability to achieve economic success and hopefully economic equality.
I want to go back to another issue, and this is a doozy, obviously, for Professor Gerhardt. And this is the flag burning piece, because it really has touched a nerve. You have the president elect and the White House even going back and forth over this issue today. As we said, Professor, in 1989, certainly the Supreme Court making that decision that it is an expression of free speech. So why isn't cross burning considered the same? And why is cross-burning, for example, illegal? And the burning of the flag considered an expression?
Well, it's a really, really good question. There may be a few different issues here. First of all, cross-burning, to some extent, may end up being treated the same. And this may depend a lot on the circumstances, which is kind of becomes a second but related issue. The circumstances may have a lot to do with it, but the Supreme Court has suggested to some extent that burning cross may actually be an expressive activity, which, however repulsive, may, for reasons you really have suggested and we've kind of alluded to, similar to the flag burning, may itself become protected. Now, but there's another thing here, and that's another critical issue, and that's the extent to which the cross-burning has, of course, been involved with intimidation, threats, all sorts of horrible activities directed against African Americans and people that supported civil rights. So it's become not just a different kind of symbol, but it's intimidating in a way and threatening in a way that flag burning is not. And so depending upon what those circumstances are in which somebody may be burning a cross, they may actually kind of cross a line, so to speak, and end up becoming almost like direct threats of physical violence against certain people. And if that happens, then it can be punishable.
And some could offer a domestic terrorism also as part of that conversation. Thank you for that. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Elizabeth, you referred to this earlier, and I want to go back to this also. What is America's second founding? Explain that, please.
Yeah, so it's really important because in many ways, the promise of the Declaration of Independence was not really written into the Constitution until our second founding after the Civil War. The drafting of the Constitution after we won our independence in the Revolution was, you know, for its time, an extraordinary act of democracy, an extraordinary affirmation of liberty. But there were people who obviously were excluded from that founding promise. And the institution of slavery was a direct repudiation of the Declaration's statement that all men are created equal and are endowed with inalienable rights. That statement is inconsistent with the idea of people who are owned by other people. So the idea that we needed a second founding to really make true the promise of the Declaration and to really pass further into that arc of constitutional progress that brings us to the great country that we have become and can yet still become is what we mean when we talk about the second founding, the 13th Amendment, which removed the stain of slavery, the original sin of the United States, from our land, the 14th Amendment, which actually wrote for the first time into the Constitution the idea that all persons deserve equality. Because while we had that exhortation in the Declaration, it wasn't truly written into the Constitution as a guarantee for all people. And we can talk about whether or not that was a reality. You know, we mentioned earlier Jim Crow, and it took obviously quite a bit of time for that constitutional guarantee to be a reality for all people in the United States and still is a work in progress. But that was, as Dr. King said, a promissory note that we knew we could try to cash mm-hmm. that was written into the Constitution after the Civil War in that second founding and just wasn't even a paper guarantee until that time.
If you could, you know, wax philosophical for a moment, because certainly we have this grand document, some would argue flexible document. And considering the way this past presidential campaign has gone, some would say not so much, because you do, you know, certainly have those who were strict interpreters, you know, of the Constitution. But what are your thoughts on, you know, the spirit of the law versus, you know, the letter of the law? Because that still seems to be today one of the biggest debates, passions inflamed this year, perhaps more than ever before.
Yeah, I think this, you know, in this moment, I've been thinking a lot about constitutional values. You know, we have, particularly when you look at the 14th Amendment, you see the ideals that, you know, any person can be an equal citizen to anyone else. You see the ideals of inclusion, the idea that people of all colors and creeds are entitled to the same equal treatment, that are entitled to be as American as anybody else. And those are important values. They also, fortunately, because of the 14th Amendment's majestic, sweeping language, they are also guaranteed rights for us. So one thing that I particularly love about the 14th Amendment is that it brings together both the spirit of the American constitutional law with the letter. And that's partly because the genius of the constitutional second founding fathers was to put this sweeping text into the Constitution. So any person, equal treatment, those are sweeping guarantees that we can claim today just as you could in 1866, 1868.
I need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the future of the 14th Amendment and where we are now. Stay with us, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue the conversation about the 14th Amendment and your rights. My guests are Elizabeth Weidra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, and Professor Michael Gerhart, University of North Carolina Constitutional Law Professor. Before I continue with this conversation, Elizabeth, talk to me about the Constitutional Accountability Center. What is it? What do you do there?
So we are a nonprofit public interest law firm, think tank, and action center that is dedicated to advancing the progressive promise of the Constitution. And we do that in several ways. We participate in actual cases in the court. We do mostly Supreme Court litigation, mostly what are called friend of the court briefs, where we will represent prominent constitutional law scholars or leaders in political office. So we, for example, have represented the Democratic leaders of Congress who drafted the Affordable Care Act and the challenge to so-called Obamacare in the Supreme Court. So we litigate those cases. We also engage in original scholarship about the meaning of a lot of the parts of the Constitution that we've had conservatives, focus on what we call the original meaning of the Constitution. So, we were talking earlier about what they were talking about when they drafted the 14th Amendment. And when conservatives have engaged in that in the past, they generally focus on the Constitution in the 18th century. And they have presented a somewhat, I would say, a misrepresentative view of the Constitution by focusing in that time period, making it about limited government and, property rights and so on. Whereas what the Constitutional Accountability Center tries to do is to focus on the whole Constitution. And so when you look at the arc of progress that is written into the Constitution, we see a document that has become more democratic, more inclusive, more just, with amendments like those of the Second Founding that brought people into the founding promise who were excluded in the 18th century. Then we look at amendments that bring in women in the 19th Amendment, that through the elimination of the poll tax in the 24th Amendment say that we will not discriminate against people based on their socioeconomic status when it comes to the fundamental aspects of citizenship. And when you look at this arc of constitutional progress, the Constitution and its guarantees are, to our mind, inherently progressive. And so we kind of take the approach that a lot of conservatives have been using, what might be called originalism or so on, and say, no, actually, when you look at the original meaning of the whole Constitution, what you see is something that is profoundly progressive. And I think that's important because it empowers people to say that, I'm claiming my rights to equality and liberty, not because it's simply the right thing to do, even though it is, but because I am owed that equality and that liberty and that equal citizenship under the Constitution itself. So whether or not the political whims of the day favor me, I'm entitled to these rights under the Constitution, and I can go into court and vindicate them. I can ask Congress to advance them. One thing we didn't talk about was the enforcement power, which we've talked about in some ways when we talked about the civil rights laws passed to make the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equality a reality, particularly for African Americans in the South who had suffered under Jim Crow and saw, sadly, the thwarting of the progress that was started after the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendments and in the early stages of Reconstruction. So I think that's one thing that CAC does, the Constitutional Accountability Center, that makes it clear that this is all Americans' Constitution, even if you weren't a white property-owning male, which a lot of folks think of when we think of our Constitution. And, a lot of people think that I'm not a part of that because there has been this focus on the way that the Constitution looked in 1789, and a lot of us don't see ourselves in that. But when you look at the whole Constitution, it's all of ours.
Professor Gerhard, with what Elizabeth just said in mind, what is the danger in 2016 for those who are looking at the Constitution as, what's the term, strict constructionists? And when they don't see it as a living, breathing document, but instead something kind of set in stone 19th century and earlier?
Well, I think there are at least two things maybe worth pointing out. I mean, one is, I think the difference between what is set in stone, as you put it, and a living constitution may not be all that great in the great scheme of things. And that is partly dependent on what's set in stone. If what's set in stone has to do with these really majestic phrases, which don't define themselves, we have to look somewhere for their meaning. And that becomes the critical question in litigation and everything else is, where do we look for the meaning? And it's not so clear that the framers even intended to have the meaning nailed down in terms of the lives of those framers or their so-called time period or their values or their traditions. So there's this great debate about the meaning, and that's one that extends over time. The other point I'd make, if I could, has to do with really a theme that we've been talking about throughout this entire conversation, but I just want to nail it down. That is, when we talk about something like the Second Founding, and we want to understand the difference between the Second Founding and the First, and this has to do with sort of the overall Constitution, Second Founding has to do with protecting minorities. And the First Founding has to do with sort of authorizing or putting a government into being. And the Second Founding is trying to protect minority rights. And so there's this great phrase I just want to read real quickly from one of the greatest of all Supreme Court opinions called West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, and the great Robert Jackson, appointed by Justice President Roosevelt. Here's what Jackson had to say, which I think captures a lot of what we're trying to say today. The very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. One's right to life, liberty, and property, to free speech or free press, freedom of worship and assembly, and other fundamental rights may not be submitted to vote. They depend on the outcome of no elections. That's much of what we're talking about today when we talk about equal protection and due process.
I'm sure that you've thought about this issue over the past 18 months or so, when there have been, certainly we saw during the Democratic National Convention, when the Kahn family, particularly the father in the Kahn family, pulled his constitution out of his jacket and challenged then-candidate Trump to read the Constitution. How problematic do you believe, Professor, how problematic do you think it is that so many Americans have not read, you know, certainly not studied, but have not even read or attempted to understand and really only seek to get information from the left, the right, the up, the down, or the middle?
Well, of course, you're asking that question to a constitutional law professor, so I want everybody to read the Constitution. That's their homework. And I might even go so far as to say that's what they owe themselves as being citizens of this country and as being residents of this country, to familiarize themselves, not to have others do it for them, but to familiarize themselves with our Constitution and even perhaps to study it, its history and the Supreme Court decisions themselves, to not depend on other people to tell them what it means, but to explore that meaning for themselves. That makes the Constitution alive in a critical sense. And I think that's something that every citizen and everybody who lives here owes to themselves, and that is to really read it themselves and to understand what it reaches and what it doesn't reach. The Constitution governs governmental action. It doesn't govern private action. But it is significant that it does govern and restrict governmental action, and much of what we're talking about and much of the debates in society depend on understanding the content and how we go about trying to construe the content of the Constitution.
Elizabeth, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, and I think, you know, look, people are busy, like Professor Gerhard and I, you know, this is what we do every day. But I think one of the great tools, and I'll plug the National Constitution Center's interactive constitution that you can find both on an app, but you can also find at, if you Google National Constitution Center interactive constitution, and they do a really great job of presenting the information where there is agreement from left, right, and center on the meaning of those provisions of the Constitution, and also present in a very succinct, short, accessible manner where there is a little bit of debate. So I think that, you know, look, for those who don't have time to get a law degree and, you know, spend a lot of time on this, that's a great way of familiarizing yourself with the Constitution. And, you know, it is something that all Americans have in common, no matter what your political persuasion is. And so it is common ground on which we can debate. You know, we often might disagree on the meaning of certain things, but it is something that belongs to all of us. And so it's something that we have in common. And, you know, I will say one of the things that I find is positive going on right now, even as I am concerned about threats to equality and liberty, is that people are looking at parts of the Constitution like, I've had more conversations about the emoluments clauses of the Constitution.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, which those prohibit officials of the United States from getting payments or gifts or titles from foreign governments, as well as the United States and state governments.
Conflicts of interest.
Exactly. Sort of like, yeah. So, you know, people are looking at the Constitution anew when you talk about targeting people because of their religion, you know, this whole threatened Muslim registry. You know, hey, that directly implicates the Constitution. You talk about a lot of these issues. You know, there was a when he was just candidate, Trump brought up stop and frisk. Well, that was ruled unconstitutional in New York because of the 14th Amendment and its interaction with the Fourth Amendment protections against searches and seizures. So, you know, getting to know your constitutional rights is arguably more important now than ever.
And that's why you're going to have this event again Thursday night, 7 o'clock. It's at the
National Archives.
The National Archives. And for more information about that, you can find it online at theusconstitution.org. That's theusconstitution.org. Elizabeth Wydra and Michael Gerhardt, thank you both for sharing with us. Good luck on Thursday, by the way, and keep plucking away, because all of us need to pick up that book and take a look, consider, study, and think about it. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, November 29th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me on Facebook at Harold Fisher, WHUR, or Twitter at H Fisher, WHUR, or at Daily Drum, WHUR. Now, stay tuned for The Connection with Lorna Newton. Good night.
The Howard University Radio Network is W.